orphanage. The word itself seems something like an antique. To a generation of Americans, the most vivid images of orphanages come not from their own memories, but from books and movies like The Cider House Rules. In this scene from that picture, one of the younger orphans, Hazel, is being adopted, much to the dismay of the older girls in the facility.
It's crazy. They should have to take the oldest first.
Please marry Agnes. This is Hazel's special day. Don't make her feel sad.
Well, Hazel's practically the youngest of us. She should be the last to leave.
At least Hazel can talk. Usually, they take one of the stupid babies.
They take the baby so they won't ever have to tell them that they're ever orphans.
I'm not a baby!
If you cry, Hazel, they'll just send you back.
Marry Agnes, that's not true.
Well, that's what they did to me.
You wanted to come back. That's why you cried.
While most American orphanages closed by the end of the 1950s, periodic reports of kids lost, brutalized, or even murdered in foster care have led to a revived interest. There are efforts underway in cities like Minneapolis and in Columbus, Ohio, to open orphanages for children who, for whatever reason, cannot live with their own families. Many sociologists, though, worry that such facilities would make it easier for states to warehouse and ignore the needs of society's most vulnerable children. Later this hour, we'll speak with an economist about why he studies Coach Bill Parcells' tendency to go for it on 4th and 2. But first, we kick off a new series on young people and the state with a conversation about orphanages and whether they have a place in 21st century America. We'd also like to hear from you, of course. Did you or a family member spend time in an orphanage, and what has that experience meant to you? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Richard McKenzie. He's the editor of Rethinking Orphanages for the 21st Century. He's also a professor at the Graduate School of Management at the University of California, Irvine. And he joins us by phone from his office there. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
You spent a considerable part of your youth in orphanages. Tell us, if you would, a little bit about how you got there and what it was like for you.
Well, both of my parents, I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina. They were severe alcoholics, and they divorced at age 5, and I basically had the run of the streets. Was a little brat at 6, 7, shoplifting and so forth. My mother committed suicide when I was 10, and her sisters hustled us off to Berrien Springs Home for Children in North Carolina, which was an orphanage, and at the time it had about 225-250 kids there.
Was this a religious institution?
It was supported by the Presbyterian Church of North Carolina, and then private donations. It had very little in the way of state or public support.
And what did it do for you in terms of education?
Well, it sort of changed my life. I considered a pivotal point in my life. Before then, I was behind in school. After then, I got some directions from people there, and I attribute whatever success I've had largely to my seventh grade teacher, who made me believe that my future was of my own making and not due to any kind of circumstances being imposed by others. But more than that, the home I grew up in would provide anybody who could get into college with financial support during college. And in fact, we went to a county high school, and I dare say no more than 10 or 20% of the kids in that county school at that time in the late 50s could anticipate they could go to college and have their way paid if they could get in.
You talked about one inspirational teacher. What were relationships like? I mean, this is a fairly big place you're talking about with
Very
the other kids.
Big. Mainly, we made our family out of our cohorts there for the most part. We had some pretty good people. There were a couple of bad rotten apples in terms of house parents. But I had a house parent for the last 2 or 3 years of my life at the home, who sent me a birthday card every year after I graduated in 1960 until her death in 1988. And that's the kind of thing you don't hear about. My seventh grade teacher 3 or 4 years ago sent me a plaque, a needlepoint 2 by 3 feet, all trying to remind me what success is. It's success of the heart and soul. And I think it's those kinds of people. But there were others. There were farmhands, a black farmhand in particular for me, coaches, and so forth. But I don't want to paint it in Pollyanna terms. It was not a perfect institution. There were problems, but on balance, it did a whale of a lot of good for a lot of kids over about a 100-year period.
When you were there, did you want to return to your family?
Well, what strikes people as odd? No. When we heard that somebody was coming on campus to adopt a 10 to 12-year-old child, and I was 10 when I went there, we would hit for the woods. We didn't want to be adopted, and the reason is pretty simple. First, if you've been in a bad family situation, you don't necessarily expect the next one to be any better. Secondly, the home I grew up in was pretty much was a pretty good place. Imagine a small college. Imagine a home where you have tennis courts and swimming pools and gymnasiums and 1,500 acres to run. And then realize that a lot of kids just don't want to make that last legal break from their parents, no matter how bad they were. I didn't want to do that to my father, in spite of the fact that he was a fall down drunk much of his life.
How do you respond to critics who believe that no matter how wonderful an orphanage might be, that it's inherently inferior to placing a child with a family such as a relative or a qualified foster or an adoptive parent?
Well, my first reaction is intensely personal. Come to homecoming with me this weekend and talk to the people I grew up with. That's one thing, and see if you don't think that these are pretty good people. Secondly, you've got to realize that foster care is probably doing a lot of good for a lot of kids, but there are many kids in the 500,000 to 600,000 kids in foster care who are not being done well by the system. It's not uncommon for a foster child to be moved from among 12 placements before he ages out of the system at age 18, and it often happens that they go through 20 and 30 and 40 placements. Now imagine moving a child that often in the course of 10 years. Recognize that many kids in foster care are spending their entire childhood going from one placement to the next. Recognize that judges have a name for these kids. They're called the plastic bag brigade, mainly because they're constantly coming back into court to seek another placement. There is a private group out there that does nothing but raise money to provide these kids with suitcases. Why? Because they live an unstable life. Mm-hmm. And what these homes can provide, they can provide a sense of security, a sense of permanence, and a sense of a place. And I should say that hugs and kisses, you know, and all of that are extraordinarily important. But there are a lot of kids out there that are getting hugs and kisses and then getting slapped against the wall and then being mistreated by a system that is really not equipped to handle as many kids as are in it.
Well, joining us now is Tim Hotchy. He's the author of Second Home, Orphan Asylums and Poor Families in America, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and he joins us from the studios of our member station there, WBUR in Boston, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
You've heard Professor McKenzie's story. Is that typical of the orphanage experience in 20th century America?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, as I think Richard would agree. By the 1950s, I think most orphanages that still functioned probably were doing a good job for at least some of the children in them. But the place he described, the home he grew up in, had tennis courts and swimming pools, and I can tell you right now that most orphanages historically have not had the kind of money required to have resources like that. Hmm. So it may not have had public funding, but it was better off than most orphanages.
Well, I guess I should add that the swimming pool we had didn't have a filtering system. and I guess I should also add that when I went to the home, there were 25 kids in this one cottage with one house parent, 8 kids to a sleeping porch. In the 1930s, though, they had 60-some kids in it. But I hasten to add that the kids who came out of this place have done well. In fact, according to research I've got, they've done much better than the general white population. All the kids there were white on all kinds of social and economic measures.
Well, Tim Hachi, let me ask you a little bit about history. And one thing that I understand, and was something of a surprise to me, is that, like Professor McKenzie, most of the orphans in these homes had at least one parent alive.
That's true. From when orphanages became fairly common in this country in the mid-19th century, a lot of the children coming into them were called half-orphans, children who had one living parent and one dead. And as time passed, that became more and more common. And in fact, by probably by 1900, a significant number of children in a lot of orphanages had two living parents who, for whatever reason, were unable to keep their children at home for some period of time.
Yeah.
And what role did immigration and illness play in the development of the orphanage?
It played a huge role. The real takeoff of orphanages in this country is between 1830 and 1850, and it was driven by cholera epidemics that hit almost every major city in 1831 and 32, and then again in 1849 and 1850. We went from about 30 orphanages in the entire country in 1830 to 200 or so by 1860, and they were built by immigrant communities to sort of protect their own. There were a lot of Irish Catholic orphanages. By 1850, some German Catholic communities were building German Catholic orphanages because they saw their children going into Irish Catholic orphanages when a parent became ill or died. There were a variety of Protestant orphanages as well. So immigration and sort of urban growth and the poverty that came with it, accompanied by illness and economic downturns, led to the creation of orphanages.
Professor McKenzie describes the home that he stayed in. It was a relatively permanent placement for him. Is that typical?
No, but it's not rare either. I would say that by the late 19th century, the majority of children who went into orphanages came out within between 1 and 3 years, and it depends on what institution you're looking at and where it is and what year. But most children were in for a couple years. There certainly were a significant number of children who came in at the age of 5 or 8 or 10 and stayed until they were 15 or 16 or 18 and old enough to leave. So orphanages took care of both kinds. They took care of kids who were sort of transient, where the family needed a year or two break before they could take the children back or before the children were placed out in somebody else's home, and then orphanages that took in children who they needed to take care of for 10, 15, or 18 years.
Richard McKenzie, why is it that the orphanage you were in finally closed?
Oh, I guess it's a variety of reasons. First off, the growth in the foster care system. Because of the stigma that we're talking about here, there was a comparison made between the warm and fuzzy foster family and the big, bad, cold institutional setting, and they were painted as warehouses, whereas, in fact, many of them were not that at all. My guess is also the 1964 Civil Rights Act had something to do with it. And the reason there is that many orphanages, at least in the South, were color-coded. Mine was in North Carolina. And I suspect the board of directors at that time probably could understand how you could have juvenile delinquent blacks and whites together, but not normal kids. I'm speculating there, but you have a large number of them closing afterwards. Another reason is that the regulations started mounting. The demands on providing high-quality care increased. The ability of kids to work on the farms and help support the institutional setting declined, and in fact, you got to the point now, if you have a child in an institutional setting in California, you can't ask him to use anything more than a 1.5-horsepower lawnmower.
Richard McKenzie, I wanted to thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Richard McKenzie, the editor of Rethinking Orphanages for the 21st Century, a professor at the Graduate School of Management at the University of California and Irvine, and he spoke with us by phone from his office there. When we come back, we'll continue talking with Tim Hachi about the future, perhaps, and certainly the past of orphanages in America. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the history of orphanages in America and the role they might play in the future of our nation's child welfare system. Our guest is Tim Hachi. He's the author of Second Home, Orphan Asylums and Poor Families in America. He's with us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at npr.org. And Let's go to the phones. Our first caller is Betty, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, Neil, thank you for having me. I hope I can get through this conversation without breaking into tears. I'm very, very similar to your first guest, Tim. Tim, I was in Thompson Orphanage in Charlotte, North Carolina. Very familiar with Byram Springs in the late 50s and early 60s. I was also in and out of the foster home, my four brothers and sisters and I, and prior to going into the orphanage. And I'm here to tell you, having experienced both, I can assure you that in my case, the foster system was corrupt. It was very brutal. My younger brother was almost beaten to death twice. And we were so grateful to get into Thompson Orphanage, which was run by the Episcopal Church and Social Services. We didn't have a tennis court or swimming pool, but we had love, discipline, caring. I also experienced wonderful teachers. I say to many people in my life that it gave me the opportunity to see another side of the world. Both my parents were living, my father an alcoholic. And I think the big difference is that the orphanages in our time, and Tim would probably agree, were based with the churches and social conscious people. We had what we called, they had what we called auxiliary parents. And I had a doctor and his wife who had six children of their own that they adopted my brother and I on weekends and Christmas holidays and things like that. So it gave us an opportunity to see the other side. No abuse. We all had chores. When I was in the orphanage, I had to put the logs in the fire to heat the water. I have very fond memories of my orphanage experience.
I don't mean to correct you, Betty, but it was Richard who had grew up in the orphanage, and I'm not
my
sure.
Apologies.
That's okay. Tim Hachi, I don't think you grew up in an orphanage, did you?
No, I didn't. I have visited a few, but.
Well, we had study halls. It was very disciplined, but it was disciplined with love. There was a farm. We didn't have a swimming pool, Richard, but we did have a lake that we went to the farm every Sunday, all of us on the back of a flatbed pickup, ate hot dogs and went swimming. And having come from the foster system, I felt like I was in heaven. And all my brothers and sisters have succeeded.
Well, Betty, thank you very much for that phone call. We appreciate it.
I would like to make one point, please, Neil.
If you could make it quickly.
Very quickly. If we can keep the government 100%, not 100% out of it, but involve people, that's what matters, the loving care of people, not as a number from the government.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, Betty. Bye-bye. I think we're going to get another view now as we go to Carol, who's with us from Riverside, California.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah, I must say that my experience growing up in an institution was not nearly so positive. There was a fair amount of abuse. There was a lack of supervision. I was abused by other students there. I won't go into the details. And generally, by the time I got out of that institution, I felt very ill prepared to deal with life in a community.
So, how long were you in?
I was in for 6 years.
As a teenager?
Yes.
And obviously, this is, from what you're saying, nothing you would recommend.
I think it could probably be carried out all right, but I think in general, either, you know, halfway houses or group homes might be preferable to many situations that a real institutional setting could offer.
Tim Hachi, let me ask you, and obviously anybody's individual situation I know you can't address, but I did want to ask you about, certainly we've heard stories about abuses in the foster care system. I'm sure the stories like Carol's were not exactly uncommon in orphanages as well.
I think that's true. In fact, there was quite a bit of criticism of orphanages starting in the 1880s and 1890s that they were raising institutionalized children who weren't going to be ready to go out in the real world. There were problems with abuse that came out into the public eye. And in 1909, there was a White House conference for dependent children, the first one, that concluded, as social workers at the time had been saying for about a decade, that the best way to deal with children who didn't have parents able to take care of them was to provide money to the parents. What we called AFDC for most of this century and now call TANF. The second best option was to put them in other homes, what we now call foster care. And the third best and last option was to put them in institutions. Now, that was a group that was selectively invited who did not support orphanages, so it was almost a foregone conclusion that would be what they came out with. But there were real problems with sort of emotional warmth and any sort of psychological development for children in orphanages in the 19th century. In the early 20th century, a lot of them did improve and made a real effort to become home-like institutions that dealt with those sorts of issues. They didn't all succeed. I think any child or any particular solution you come up with, foster care, orphanages, adoption, what have you, is going to work for some children in some settings and not work for others.
Hmm. Carol, I wanted to thank you very much for the call. I know these kinds of conversations aren't easy.
Right. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Appreciate it. And Tim, I just wanted to follow up on a point you made. Am I hearing correctly that the institution of AFDC, or what a lot of people would call welfare, that played a role in the demise of the orphanage? In other words, that parents who would otherwise have had to put their child in an orphanage so that they could continue to support themselves could now get welfare payments and not do that?
It played a huge role. As of 1910, there were probably about 800 orphanages in this country. It was sort of the main way of taking care of children whose families couldn't take care of them. There was some public support in some places. By and large, they were private institutions. And in the 1910s, states all across the country passed what was called mother's pensions or widow's pensions legislation to provide a limited amount of money to a widow or to a mother to keep her kids at home if poverty was the only reason that she wasn't able to care for her children. And orphanages continued to grow. By 1930, there were about 1,300 in the country. But the AFDC plan that came out of the New Deal in the mid-1930s was basically a federal version of these mothers' pensions plans. And it got the federal government and state governments involved in providing for kids whose problem was chiefly that their families were poor. Hmm. So those children didn't need to go into institutions anymore. And a lot of orphanages starting in the 1930s either sort of transform into placement agencies that are putting children out in homes, or they became more specialized institutions that provided for children with severe emotional or behavioral problems rather than children who were brought to their doors by parents or relatives saying, we're too poor, we can't take care of this child anymore. So there was a shift in the clientele, and it was driven partly by public money becoming available for orphanages or for particular kinds of care of children.
Orphanages, like a lot of other institutions of their time, were closed to African Americans, and some critics of the contemporary orphanage movement are concerned about the potential impact on black and other minority children. Joining us now to discuss that is Dorothy Roberts, the author of Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare. She's also a fellow at the Northwestern University Institute for Policy Research, and she joins us from her home in Evanston, Illinois. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. Good to be here.
In the late 19th and early 20th century, how did the black community handle children who otherwise would have been placed in orphanages?
Well, you're right. The white-created orphanages were really there for poor white children, and even the mother's pensions that were just mentioned were also created for poor white mothers and their children. Black children were left out of both the institutions and left out of the public assistance that was given to poor families. And so the black community cared for them by networks of kin, relatives, and neighbors who took children in. And also they created their own...
Excuse me, Dorothy, I'm sorry, we're losing your phone line. I think you're using one of those handheld phones, a cordless phone. If you could get closer to your home base, I think we'd be better off.
Okay, I'm really sorry about that.
That's okay.
The engineers noted a problem with the phone as well. I'm going to try to get closer.
It's sounding fine now.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, black children were excluded both from orphanages and other kinds of institutions that were created at the turn of the century, and they were also excluded from the mother's pensions that were created later on in order to avoid children going into orphanages. So black communities were left to their own devices, which was primarily for children to be taken in by relatives and by neighbors. And also there was quite a bit of African-American women creating more informal orphanages or boarding houses in their homes. And there are many, many examples of women who, many of whom were slaves, were born into slavery after emancipation, who handled the problem of black children whose parents couldn't care for them by bringing 10, 20, 30, 40, sometimes 60 of them into boarding houses. Later they created more stable institutions for black children.
And were they organized, as we heard Tim Hotchey say, along religious lines, as the Irish Catholics or the German Catholics might have?
Well, not primarily. Some of them were church-based orphanages, and churches were a big supporter of homes and other kinds of institutions for black children, but they weren't the kind of determining factor that excluded children. It was based more along racial lines than religious lines.
Let's get another caller. Ernie joins us on the line from Dayton, Ohio.
Good afternoon. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Nice to have you.
Spent 5 years in an orphanage in Xenia, Ohio, and prior to that had spent 7 years in a foster care system in the state of Ohio. The institution of the home in Xenia, which was called the Ohio Soldiers and Sailors Orphanage, was military-based. So it was started up at in 1869 and was set up because of the military of the Civil War and orphanage from the orphans from the Civil War. So we had the military influence where we, the superintendents and most of the people who worked there, had some affiliation with the military as far as retirement. And for me, going to the orphanage at age 13 was like a lifesaver versus being in the foster care system for 7 years. Because I think that any kid who languished that long in the system should either try to terminate parental right and adopt these kids out, or in my case, or to put us somewhere where we can learn skills and be able to get ready to prepare to be adults and contribute in life. And institutions aren't the perfect thing. You know, I don't want people thinking that orphanages, you know, are perfect and there's no problem. There, you know, there's a lot of problems with bullying. You can have a problem with the adults working there taking advantage of the girls and boys sexually. But it does provide a sense of security as far as you're there with a bunch of kids who are there because they are poor, and you can find commonality and camaraderie with each other in that situation.
Well, Ernie, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
We're talking about the history of orphanages and whether they might have a future in the child welfare system of the 21st century. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And Dorothy Roberts, before we let you go, I understand that you're worried that black children could be disproportionately placed in orphanages should those facilities make a comeback. What leads you to believe that, and why would that be a problem?
Well, black children fare the worst in the U.S. child welfare system by every single measure. They're the most likely of any children in the country to be placed in foster care. When they come to the attention of the child welfare system, they're more likely to be put in foster care than left at home with their family being given services. They spend the most time in foster care. They're the least likely to be returned home or adopted, and they're the most likely to be placed in institutional care, like group homes. So they are treated the most harshly and given the most institutionalized types of services of any children. And I don't want to, the fact that foster care is supposed to be a temporary placement, and ideally children should be returned home. We hardly ever hear talk anymore about giving supports to families so that they can take care of children themselves. And I think that orphanages are being promoted as a way to solve the problem of the huge foster care population, which is largely a problem of the failure to give supports to black families and turning to this kind of out-of-home institutionalized care, especially for black children. So I have no doubt in my mind that the children who are going to be placed in orphanages will be disproportionately black, and we'll continue as we are now with the children who go home and who get services in their homes being more likely to be white.
Dorothy Roberts, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Dorothy Roberts is the author of Shattered Bonds, The Color of Child Welfare, and a fellow at the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. She was with us by phone from her home in Evanston, Illinois. And Tim Hachi, I wanted to ask you, how much steam is there, as far as you know, behind the movement now in some places to reconsider the orphanage option?
Well, I think there's a lot of steam in certain places to build one orphanage or two orphanages and try to get some children either from the foster care system or from outside of the foster care system into those orphanages. In terms of it becoming a major national movement, you know, it's been talked about for more than 10 years now. Intermittently, there are little waves where people advocate it. I don't think there's any likelihood that orphanages are ever going to become a central part of the child welfare system in the way that they once were, and I think that's probably a good thing. Because in the past, the best thing about orphanages were that they were a local institution, and they were controlled by local groups. Children went back to their families relatively quickly. Now I think they clearly wouldn't be local institutions if they're built. Children probably would not go back to their families quickly. But I do want to say that I think as one of the things that could be done to help improve the foster care system, I think some return to orphanages for appropriate children is not a bad idea. The problem is it's extremely expensive to do it right.
Joining us now is Mary Ford, a research associate at the North American Council on Adoptable Children. She joins us from her office in Minneapolis, and good of you to be with us.
Thank you.
And I know there's a controversy there in Minneapolis about a proposed orphanage. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yes, the proposed orphanage for the Twin Cities area of Minneapolis and St. Paul would perhaps house up to 200 children who would come from the foster care system. It's very unclear, and it always has been unclear in this proposal, if those children would be 4 years old, if they would have no problems, if they would be older children, if they would be highly disturbed. It's very unclear with this proposal who exactly would be served by this orphanage.
And what stage is that in right now?
The state that it's in right now is a local city planning commission and city council gave approval, zoning approval, about a year ago for the orphanage plan to move forward, which shows you in some ways the sort of the folly of how states and local governments are able to decide whether there's a need for this type of more restrictive care, when actually, in fact, it seems to be being decided by city planning commissions based on zoning laws that deal with sewage and widths of roads.
More with Mary Ford and Tim Hachi on the issue of orphanages and their possible place in the 21st century when we come back from a short break. Our telephone number, if you'd like to get involved, 800-989-8255. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about whether orphanages should return as part of America's child welfare system. Our guest is Tim Hachi, the author of Second Home, Orphan Asylums and Poor Families in America, and also with us Mary Ford, a research associate with the North American Council on Adoptable Children. And Mary Ford, I know that you are very opposed to the idea of orphanages coming back. Can you briefly tell us why?
Yes, I can. I think it's important to note that only the U.S. and China are moving in the direction of institutionalizing more children. Other industrialized nations around the world are looking at going the opposite direction, making families safe for children to return to, or finding alternative families for kids. And that's based on some really good reasons. In the U.S., very few children who leave congregate care settings like orphanages, very few of those kids are adopted. And that's based on a study of 500,000 children over a 12-year period it's an ongoing study that the University of Chicago is conducting. Children from congregate care placements, like orphanages, are more likely than others to age out, to run away, and actually to return to the foster care system. So there's some very good reasons why other industrialized nations, other places, are looking at the advantages of family-based care for foster children.
And obviously the good of the children is everybody's goal, yet we do hear reports of neglect and abuse in the foster care system.
Yes. Here in Minnesota, the rate of confirmed neglect and abuse of foster children was less than 1%. which is I believe what the national target is. So I think the notion that children are being abused and neglected in foster care is somewhat overstated. I think that we need to look at the fact that institutions or orphanages really deny children future chances for a family. Nationally, here in the U.S., 60% of children adopted from the child welfare system are adopted by their foster parents, and a growing number, which is right now about 23%, are adopted by relatives. In fact, relatives are stepping up to the plate in increasing numbers to care for children either through an adoption arrangement or, in some cases, through a new and slightly different arrangement, a subsidized guardianship arrangement. These are the kinds of things we need to be supporting. They're better for children. They are cheaper, and they really provide for children's mental and social health the way that a family can and the way that an institution cannot.
Mary Ford, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mary Ford, a research associate for the North American Council on Adoptable Children, and she spoke with us from her office in Minneapolis. And Tim Hotchey, I know that historically speaking, had relatives been available to adopt some of these children, there may have been less need for orphanages.
Well, I think that's true. You're talking about children going in who simply don't have family members who are able financially and otherwise to take care of them, at least in the short run. My great-grandmother died while giving birth to my grandmother. But my grandfather was a middle-class man, and he paid his sister to take care of his daughter for the next 18 years. Poor families often don't have that option.
Let's get some more callers in. Dave joins us on the line from Erie, Colorado. Hello, Dave. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air.
Yes. I spent 4 years in a, I guess you'd say, orphanage slash boarding school slash a juvenile delinquent home when I was between the ages of like 8 and 12. And it was not a good situation. It was adults were, all the adults were disciplinarians. I can remember seeing a kid get wailed on with a canoe paddle at one time. Spanking was, 16 swats with a cribbage board, one kid getting. And it was just, I guess the best thing that I could think of to compare it to would be, it was kind of like a prison culture of how the kids interacted. There was kids there who were orphans. There was kids there who were just from, you know, their parents had separated. They had no place to live.
Mm-hmm.
There was kids there who had been taken away from their parents because they were abused. There was kids there who were sent there because they, you know, their parents couldn't control them. And it was a very unusual environment. And
I could still hear the emotion in your voice.
It was very strange. It was run by a group of Catholic nuns from Germany who were extremely strict disciplinarians, and anything you did, you were physically punished, you know, if you stepped out of line. And adults were looked upon merely as disciplinarians. And I know there was kids there from the age of 3, you know, on up till they finished grammar school. And the only adults they were exposed to were the people who disciplined them. So it was, and I, looking at that, I can see where it would be very difficult to weed that out of an institution where you're putting a whole bunch of kids together and, you know, trying to build a, you know, a community of some kind. Because it's not a community. It's very strange. I mean, you learn very quickly that you had to get a group of friends and you stayed in groups. You didn't go alone because if you were out in the playground alone, you were looked upon as a target, as a victim. So you stayed in groups, and that was how you protected yourself.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. And again, I know these stories are not easy to tell.
Anyway, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I wanted to see if we get one last call in on this subject. Ann joins us from Long Island in New York.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was in an orphanage from the time I was 5 until I was 18. It was a church-run, a Lutheran orphanage in Pennsylvania. There were some difficult times, but looking back, I think that most of the things that I gained from it were positive. I became a nurse, and that was because of them. I had a lot of privileges, as they called them, piano lessons. Singing was in place. We went to the local town for school. We learned gardening. There were some very good counselors. And
so not a perfect place, maybe, but better than where you were coming from.
Yes. And my sister and I were both there now a few years ago when there was some talk about reestablishing orphanages. I said, I think that's the best thing they could do for all these troubled children. And my sister was furious with me because her experiences, she felt, were different.
Hmm.
And
she was in the same institution.
Right, right. But she was a little bit more rebellious than I. And she feels that some of the things that she was punished for weren't appropriate. And, of course, some of the people that I've since had contact with since I've been there, feel the same, that it was strict and it wasn't loving. But for some reason, most of the people that I came in contact with were very supportive, encouraged me. The one thing that I did found difficult was that there still was that looking for love and wanting to be loved, and wondering why I was there, and why my mother had abandoned me. Hmm. And that's taken me a long time to adjust to. Wow. I'm 65 now, but it was not the worst place in the world, and I think I'm a better person having been there.
Anne, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye. Tim Hotchie, obviously these are all anecdotal stories, individual accounts of the long story of orphanages in America.
They are. I think what they show more than anything else is that there are good orphanages and bad orphanages, and that if we're talking about how to improve child welfare now and how to care for children, that we should probably put less energy into the debate of adoption versus foster care versus orphanages than we should into providing quality versions of each one. I think orphanages can play an important role within the foster care system for 10, 11, 12-year-old children who, as Richard McKenzie pointed out, when they go into foster care, often bounce from one placement to another and then wind up in a group home after several very unstable years. But we need to worry more about quality, not thinking foster care is great or adoption is great and foster care is bad, or orphanages are great and foster care is bad. There were terrible orphanages and there were very good orphanages, and we need to try and make sure that whatever we're providing for children is tailored to them and is of high quality, rather than worry about which particular category it falls into.
Tim Hotchie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tim Hotchie's book is Second Home, Orphan Asylums and Poor Families in America, and he joined us on the line from our member station in Boston, WBUR. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.